Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn. It is my pleasure to introduce Manoush Zamori, podcast host and author of Bored and Brilliant, How Spacing Out Can Unlock Your Most Productive and Creative Self. Investigating how technology is transforming humanity is Manoush's passion. She co-founded the Stable Genius Productions, a media company to help people navigate personal and global change. Manoush has won numerous awards and is especially proud of the Webby Award her team won this year for The Privacy Paradox, an interactive digital program about personal data. She was named one of Fast Company's 100 most creative people to watch in business, and her TED Talk about surviving information overload has been viewed by more than 2 million people. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Manoush.
Hey, everybody.
So, welcome. Welcome
Thank
to Silicon
you.
Valley.
I'm so happy to be here.
Tell me about this amazing book that you wrote that I'm really excited to have read. Tell me about what prompted you to write this. What was kind of the genesis for all of this coming together in the first place?
Yeah, so this was not a book to begin with. This was a personal problem. This was me sitting down around 2014, 2015. I'm a podcaster. I was running a radio show. My purpose in life was to have creative ideas. And I sat down one day to got the blank page, got my cup of coffee, let's do this. And the blank page stayed very blank. And I was panic stricken, frankly. I was like, this has never been a problem for me coming up with ideas. And so I started to think, like, when was the last time the ideas just came flowing out or it was really easy? And I actually thought back to one of the hardest times in my life was after my first kid was born, and he was born the same month as the iPhone, so June 2007. And this was like, he was the most colicky baby you have ever seen. He would only sleep if I was walking, and I had a flip phone because I'm not an early adopter, and I didn't have time to go line up to get an iPhone. And so all I could do was walk. And this went on for months so this kid could sleep. And that was when I had my most incredible ideas. And so I'm thinking back, bittersweet to that time and thinking, like, what is different now in my life? Oh, it's this thing. Because now, whenever I'm bored or I feel uncomfortable, what do? I look at this thing.
This thing being your iPhone.
Yeah. And it made me think, like, I am never bored. But that's good, right? Like, aren't only boring people get bored? But then I was like, well, what if we never get bored again? What if this human state is completely, like, wiped away? Will we be actually missing something? What happens when we get bored and what would happen potentially if we get rid of it, if we never get bored? And so that led me down this crazy rabbit hole of talking to neuroscientists and cognitive psychologists and starting to understand what happens in the brain when we get bored. And it is just fascinating. It is we ignite a network in our brain called the default mode. So this is not when you're meditating. This is when you are folding socks or going for a walk. Maybe when you're talking to your mom, I don't know, depending how, or my mother-in-law in that case. This is when your mind just goes and it starts to wander away. And it turns out that boredom is actually a gateway to what they officially call mind wandering. Some people refer to it as daydreaming. The default network is actually often called the imagination network. And you do amazing things when this network is ignited. You do your most original problem solving. You take one disparate idea, you take another one, you smash them together to create something completely new. And you do something that I had never heard of before, which I thought was fascinating. It's called autobiographical planning. This is where you look back at your life last week, 10 years ago, whatever, and you take note of the highs and the lows, and you start to string them together to create a story about yourself. And then you look forward and you think, well, where, what are the next chapters going to be? And what are the goals that I need to set and steps I need to take to get there? So this all seemed incredibly important to me. And so I went back to my listeners and I was like, I don't know, you guys, like I'm learning all this crazy stuff. What if we took a week and experimented with our digital habits and we tried to get bored more and we try and figure out, like, see what actually happens? And so I put out that call, and within, I figured, like, you know, maybe a couple hundred people would sign up and that'd be fun. But within 48 hours, 20,000 people signed up to do this. And I was like, okay, not a special snowflake at all. This is a problem that's obviously on people's minds. And so the book is based on that one week that we every day issued a challenge. We sent out a special podcast where we asked people to do something special that day, and we can go into what those things were. And then we included in the podcast why we did that. What was the science or the design or the hypothesis that other researchers had that sort of was the reason why we chose it for that day. And we did something slightly counterintuitive, which was we partnered with a couple apps to measure people, because people love to quantify themselves, right? Like, you gotta meet people where they are. So they could measure every day how many minutes a day they were on their phone and how many pickups a day. Because my problem wasn't the time. Mine was the constant picking up. Like, I'd get into an elevator and I'd look at my phone. I'd get out of an elevator. I'd look at my phone. I'd get to my desk. I'd look at my... What was I looking for? I don't know. So we wanted to measure both the data as to how we changed collectively. But then, of course, it's a podcast. So we had people telling us their stories of what happened to them. And for the book, I took all of that and then went back and did a ton more research and sort of made a couple changes based on what we had learned from that week and codified it there.
So you are an incredible early adopter to this concept. I mean, everywhere now people are talking about,
yeah.
you know, addiction and our, you know, the damage that overuse of technology or overuse of social media is doing to our creativity and our minds and our motivations and our habits. And this was something that you were onto,
yeah,
years before Zuckerberg was called in front of Congress.
That's right. That's just 3 years ago. And at the time, people were like, oh, you know, she's an anti-tech person. That's super weird. I was like, A, I'm not an anti-tech person at all. I love my phone and I want to continue to love my phone. But also, it's extraordinary to me that in just the 3 years since that happened, that was seen as kind of a weirdo public radio kind of thing to do. And here we are 3 years later, and iOS, the latest operating system for iOS includes actually screen time. Are any of you using it?
Yes.
You are using it whether you want to or not. Yeah. If you have upgraded your phone, it's in there, and it will tell you how many minutes a day you have spent looking at email. It'll tell you how many you played a game, whether you want to or not. So, and I actually had coffee with one of the activist shareholders who really pressed Apple to make that addition to the iOS operating system. And why did he do it? Because he's a concerned parent. That was one of the main reasons. So like the world has, everything is accelerating, right? This included, definitely.
Yeah. So briefly tell us, what were those 7 days, those 7 steps that you took?
I won't bore you with all of them.
But you know,
I'll give you some of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my, two favorites that I had. One was, it sounds so dumb when you say it out loud, put it in your pocket. Like, just don't look at it when you're in transit. And that meant something different to a lot of people, like your subway ride. For one mom who was nursing, it meant that she didn't take it with her to the bathroom. like that was as far as she was going from like being on the sofa. So whenever you were going somewhere, just don't look at your phone. And the idea was, what we heard from so many of our listeners was that the phone had become kind of a binky, and that, you know, used to... back in the day, go out for a smoke. Well, now you go and look at your phone, right? So the physical habit actually has been shown. There is the haptic response that you get from looking at your phone. It becomes a habit like anything else does. And so that's where the pickups started to come in, where people were like, I had no idea. I was checking my phone 200 times a day, and I remembered maybe 20 of them in my mind, but nobody remembers checking their phone 200 times a day. So simply like being mindful and no judgment, right? Like just like in Zen Buddhism, like just being mindful of where your phone was and when you were looking at it. And then taking the time, for me, it was really the subway ride home, taking the time to just see like what happens. And I got really obsessed with toenail polish colors because that's what I was looking at. But then also I started coming up with really good ideas for ways to help my kid with his homework, as opposed to playing Two Dots, which was my game of choice. Any Two Dots players in the audience?
Don't raise your hand. Oh, you raised your hand. See you. You're very brave.
We have a secret bond that no one will ever understand. But I want to say, like, what I found was that, you know, it's not technology is bad or technology is good. It's the use case, right? So one of the people I speak to is Jane McGonigal at the Institute for the Future, not mm-hmm. far from here, who sort of talks about using games in a very productive way. So for example, kids in pediatric hospitals, it's been shown like pre-surgery, post-surgery, that is a great time to get a kid to play a game. And Jane's become a friend, and I was telling her about, like, I had this crazy long flight to Australia, and I was feeling kind of petrified. She's like, put the damn game back on your phone. Like, what are you going to do, drink your way to Australia? Play the game. And she's right. Like, so now I have it on my phone, and it's for bumpy takeoffs and landings. It's a little special treat that I give myself.
It's when an adult needs a binky.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly. Yes. Right. I don't have my blankie anymore, but I have my game when I need it. And it's appropriate, you know? It's fine.
Right.
So, okay. So that was day one. I want to tell you about day three.
Good.
Day three was called Delete That App. And we asked people to take the app that was like making them crazy. You know, the one that makes you feel icky, like
you're the one that you're just using too much.
Right.
Or
the one that like, it's not for work. It's like, we heard from, mostly it was Facebook that got deleted. The one that like, you're like, I'm kind of on here and I kind of like it. Oh my God, 2 hours just went by. Shit. So we asked people to just take it off their phone just for the day, just to see what it felt like. And it was fascinating to see what people said. Some of them were like, one guy, Liam, was like such a type A person. He's like, I took Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook. He listed like seven others. Like I took them off my phone and I am never putting them back on. And I was like, yeah, right, Liam. But when the book came out 2 years later, he's like, I never put them back on my phone. I loved the way it felt not having them there, not like they felt like they were calling out to me all the time. And I was, he felt like released, which was fascinating to me. Another person was like, I've decided that every Wednesday Twitter comes off my phone just so I remember that I can live without it. People started to make really interesting rules for themselves.
But they took it off, but then they put it back
on. They
put
it back on.
On Thursday.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So it's
exactly.
a cycle.
Just all a right. reminder. Like really, and I just think it's so interesting to think about this really personal relationship that people have with these platforms. Yeah, sure, it's the people, you know, your family and friends on Facebook, but it's also a very personal relationship you have with the company actually mm-hmm. too, because you are telling it all your secrets, your everything. And as we know, sometimes they are using it in ways that you have no idea or intended to. So
delete an app.
What's another good one? Oh, we took, take a focation or fakecation as it's now called in the book, because focation was confusing to people, where we asked people to like write an out of office email, even if you are not out of your office, like for 1 hour, just try it. Like, and if you had to lie, because, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, their boss is not going to be psyched about them. Say you have a stomach virus just for an hour. It's fine. No one will, trust me, when you say you have a stomach virus, your boss will not call you. Take an hour off and just do the deep work. Because I think what we also heard from people is Slack and other ways that certainly are helping us as teams communicate with each other. They're also driving us a little crazy, like the pinging, the notifications, the constant need to tell someone what you're doing. There's a wonderful researcher who found, well, this part's not so wonderful, but she found that if for 1 hour you are constantly interrupted by your colleagues or by email or whatever else, even if you shut down email or you close your door and tell people not to bother you, you will begin to interrupt yourself for the next hour. So it's that...
Because you've trained
exactly,
your brain.
Right.
You've created the habit in
right.
your brain of not being able to have a thought and carry it through.
Precisely. Exactly right. So this field of informatics, this computer-human relationship that's happening, I think it's unprecedented. We're every day is an experiment. We are the lab, and I think that it's interesting. I think consumers are often left out of the conversation, and they have a lot to say mm-hmm. if they begin to understand how the design decisions are made. What the business models are for many of these apps, of course, you know, we're here in Palo Alto. And I think we're at an incredible moment where those are finally being questioned.
One of the things that I think is particularly interesting, I'm a mom, I have four kids, I live and work here in Silicon Valley, and so I've raised all my kids up through the system, and so a lot of my kids' friends
yeah.
are, like me, executives at various tech companies, because that's who we are around here.
The parents. Yeah.
And I put my kids through Montessori schools, uh-huh. and I noticed that a lot of other tech executives do the same thing. And, you know, and then you read about Steve Jobs wouldn't let his kids have, you know, an iPad, and a lot of the, you know, people who are pushing for the change in the future of jobs and the change in the future of skills and work, and maybe we need a universal basic income because we're going to have too many humans and not enough jobs. That was mm-hmm. a story from a bunch of years ago. These are the people who are saying, you know, I don't want my kids using technology because I know the damaging effects of a saturated life, you know, immersed in technology.
I mean, I've heard that too, and it's in the book, a lot of Waldorf people, and it's incredibly frustrating to me. Like, it's not okay for your kids, but it's okay for mine. Like, and so I really wanted to test that, and I went to spend a day with a Google exec. This was in New York, a Google exec, and I love this. He's married to a child psychologist. I was like, you guys are perfect together. I love it. So I went to spend the day with him because I was like, what are you doing with your kids? Like, how is a Google software engineer parenting compared to, like, me who can't code? And it was kind of great to watch. Like, they actually spent time building stuff, and it was really he and his son, it was together time, and they were making things, and I was jealous. I was like, I can't do that with my kid. So what are the rest, you know, they were still, don't get me wrong, they had to set timers and all the rest of it. Oh, I just remembered something. They did a really fascinating experiment of their own. They decided to see if their, I think he was 9 when they did this, or maybe 8, what would happen if they were like, all the screen time you want, Sunday, all of it, just do what you want, to see if, like, actually, it's bullshit. He would self-regulate. You don't have to put a timer. Parents are just making this up. Oh, my God. So the kid, like, literally was like this for 15 hours, I think.
And was nose to the screen.
Nose to the screen, and like was like shaking by the end of it. They were like, okay, bad experiment over. Call it. So I was like, well, but at least you're testing it. Like, and now you can say to your kid, we tried that. It didn't work. So now we're going to go to half an hour a day, and here's the timer. But I, as I said, I was really envious that he was able to connect with the technology in a way that I, as a person who is not a technologist, just can't do. And so I have a lot of parents who ask me, like, well, so I feel like, put your phone away. And I'm like, yeah, it's so boring, especially since you're probably on your phone, right? That's what a lot of kids in the we've had a lot of schools who have done Bored and Brilliant, and the kids are like, I'm not the problem. It's my mom. She can't put her phone away. So, you know, look at thyself, parents. Yeah. How has it changed, though? You have kids from like
25 to 15.
So how has parenting changed for you? Like that's a fascinating experiment that you're having going on in your house. Like,
yeah. So we're pretty much technology free. So we don't have a TV, and you know, they have phones which they use if there's an emergency and things like that, but they're not, you know, fingers they're not thumbs on the screen all the time.
What's your policy with social media?
They can have it if they want to, but they've chosen not to.
None of them?
No, I mean, the 25-year-old does, for sure, because he needs it for work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the rest of them, I think, have – it was actually the schools that introduced it to them.
Isn't that interesting?
Because when each of them went to high school, they were like, well, the water polo game schedule is on Facebook.
It's on Facebook, right.
And if there's a change to the carpool plan, it's on Facebook. And so my kids were like, I don't have Facebook, so how am I supposed to find out whatever, you know? And it was like, okay, the play auditions, you missed the play auditions, because we put the update on Facebook. And my daughter was like, well, how was I supposed to know? You know? So it was actually the school that pushed them along. But they had cousins that had bad experiences and, you know, mm-hmm. bullying online and things like that. So my kids decided, you know, that they just didn't want it.
That's so interesting. I mean, to be clear, like, I've also spoken to a lot of teenagers who, you know, if you are the only person, insert unconventional descriptor here, who is gay or trans or any of those things, and you live somewhere where that's not acceptable, social media and the internet obviously are incredible connectors.
Right.
Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement,
right.
There are like really cool things happening, but it's just a matter of making sure that we ask very carefully and cautiously, how do we have more of the good and less of the bad?
Right.
And I think, you know, this conversation obviously has intensified in large part because of the 2016 presidential election and some of the understanding of what exactly happened with misinformation. We just partnered with the Knight Foundation, who did really interesting research looking at how fake news, and I use it in quotations, but fake news spread before the election and after the election. And there's been this sort of assumption that misinformation on these platforms is whack-a-mole, right? Like, if you ban someone from the site, what difference does it make? Somebody else is going to show up right away. But actually, they took millions and millions and millions of tweets and then broke them down and mapped them back to their source. And it wasn't that many sites. It was like several dozen sites, not hundreds of sites. And these sites, whether they're InfoWars or RT or whatever they are. Some of them were Russian troll farms. Others were not. And 95% of what they were publishing was actually verifiable news. But it was that 3 to 5% that once in a while they just throw a doozy in there right at the right time and then just pump it across Twitter. That is the source of where the communication or the fake news and misinformation was happening. And other researchers have found that it specifically happened in swing states right in the days right before, mm-hmm. of course, the election. So, I mean, some people are like, I don't understand. What does getting bored and putting down your phone have to do with geopolitical movements? And I'm like, oh, you'd be surprised.
Is it because it makes us sort of vulnerable and almost like weakens our immune system to you know, if we're always like that 15-year-old, or sorry, no, the 9-year-old who you're saying the son of the software engineer,
yeah.
that spent 15 hours online, and then towards the end you're sort of shaking, you know, you're vulnerable, your immune system is down, and then the fake news can come in, and if you spend a lot of time with a technology or your face in a screen, does it make you more vulnerable or susceptible, or you start to question less, or you're... Is that how it sort of breaks through?
I think there's a lot packed into that. I think part of it, again, is that these platforms, as you know, are extremely Oh, I hope you're okay back there. Are okay. Very personalized, right? So they know exactly what you're looking for. They know how to target. I mean, I'm not saying anything. None of you, if you live here, you know all this. But I think what's different now is that we are integrated in a way when it comes to, and I look at this from a journalism perspective, right? Like we every news feed we see is personalized to us. There's no collective, these are the headlines of the day. No one agrees on what the big news is. And that's kind of cool. And it's also a little bit scary. But I think what we're saying is that you need to be given different tools. Us as adults who only got turned on to this technology in the last 10 years and kids who've never known life without it. We have to be rethinking what digital literacy is, what regulation, self-regulation, I think, becomes incredibly important. And what I hear from teachers that I have found fascinating is not only that they're having to tell people how to not only are they having to teach kids, like, here's how you know if a source is believable, but they're having to teach them things that they've never had to teach in class, like eye contact, listening, taking time to reflect on something that they've read, sort of human things that they've never have never been an issue. But now that their lives are so mediated by screens, they have to schedule those things and prioritize those things in the classroom. And I think I'm hearing that from people in the workplace as well, that like you have to almost make sure that you schedule time to think about the report that you just read. Leslie Perlow, she's a professor at Harvard, did an experiment that actually Boston Consulting Group, they now use in thousands of their offices, which was that they actually scheduled in time off for team member because per team member because they were having such problems with retention. People were getting so burned out. And so I think, you know, we can come to an understanding, and this brings us back to full circle to the book, that this we think we're being so productive by answering emails and getting so much done, I'm getting so much done and answering blah, blah, blah. But actually, I think we're confusing productivity with responsiveness. We're just constantly responding. What are we actually producing? At the end of the day, if I can say that I produced 20 email responses, that's kind of depressing. But if I come up with like an amazing idea of a way to solve a problem at work, or I figure out a problem, you know, think of a new product for us to report about or whatever, something that is meaningful and manageable and we can move forward on, that is obviously much more satisfying.
Yeah, you mentioned in your book some really interesting ideas that is interesting and also scary, that it's clear that the designers of technology understand a great deal around the psychology of the human brain and the human and human motivation, and are specifically designing things in a way to keep us addicted. So the idea of the scarce resource,
yeah,
and that if there's not very much of something, I better hurry and go get it, and there's a time limit for it. So there's a lot of that psychology built into games, and you know it's only five more, you know, one more life, one more treasure I have to get, or another pile of electronic coins, and then I can go have another life, and then I can go do a next level of this game.
Translate that to shopping, online shopping. Translate that to Twitter, and every time you scroll, why does it always seem like you have so many likes? Oh, wait. Have you noticed that like you've actually seen a lot of those before? They just package them up again so that you, when you scroll down, it looks like there's new activity. You can translate that to any of these technological products. And, you know, until the business model changes, that's how they're making their money. Like it's free, right? Like that's that's what the Privacy Paradox Project was about. This idea of, you know, I think a lot of American consumers sort of didn't realize they were entering into a pact that every time they use something for free, it's not free. They're handing over all their personal data. Like one guy, we asked people in that project to go through their apps and see what was being collected on them. And he's like, I discovered that my flashlight app had access to my microphone, to my location, and to all my contacts. Why does my flashlight app need that? delete, you know. So
how do you find that out? If people want to do that, I mean, how do you go through the process of understanding, okay, what does my flashlight app have access to? How do I figure that out?
I mean, it's in your settings. You just have to, like, people don't want to get into the guts, right? It's there. So what we did was we created GIFs for people to see how to get into their settings. Like, that's something that I like to do, but like my mom has no idea. Like, and most of our listeners were like, wait, what? How do we do this? So yeah, it's like best just telling people. Like, it's not revelatory. It's just like, okay, so you got to go in there and then go deeper there and see what this is here. And we're not saying like delete it all. We're saying like decide.
Be thoughtful.
Right. Or is the service that this app is giving you enough that you've decided it's worth the trade-off? And if you've decided, cool, own it, you know, but no.
But do it purposefully.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now back to our program.
Yeah. In my line of work, in human resources, we think a lot about the future of work and the future of skills and how jobs will change in the future and sort of the understanding of what does it mean to be employed and employee, all of this, and think a lot about the skills for the future. And so we come back to, in my work, the World Economic Forum, sort of the 16 skills for the future. It's critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, innovation. Innovation,
yes.
Empathy, emotional intelligence, resilience, grit, leadership, you know, all of these very human skills.
Yeah.
And that with longevity, that we are, I mean, it's wonderful, we are living so much longer as a species. You know, it used to be the case you'd have a 40-year career. I will have a 50-year career. My kids will have a 60-year career because they're just living longer and healthier longer and capable of working longer. And really, you need to have this fundamental human skills to be able to adapt to a 60-year career. Because you can't say this XYZ technology or you know other knowledge set will be consistent. But what will be consistent is our humanity and our ethical, challenging way that we deal with problems and we adapt and change. So that kind of comes full circle to, I'm kind of concerned about what we're teaching in schools and the role that technology has in our lives, because I feel like they're pulling away some of that humanity, right? That critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, innovation. Are we over-rotating on teaching STEM skills, teaching programming to kids and not enough of a foundation in you know, asking the right, not necessarily knowing what the right answer is, but how do you even know what the right question is?
Yeah.
And
because the machines won't need you to code them.
No. I mean, that's what machine learning
right,
is.
Yeah.
It's software that writes software. Yeah, so we don't need as many programmers in the future.
And actually, there was a survey done by IBM of, I think it was like 1,000 CEOs, and the number one quality that they said they'd be looking for in the future was creative thinkers and leaders.
Right.
So I think you're, you know.
So are we filling every possible little a minute with distractions and escaping through technology and not allowing ourselves to really wrestle with and challenge ourselves to be critical thinkers and creative problem solvers with too much technology sort of filling in the gaps and all of the white space?
I think it's a privileged position to be able to say that. There are obviously people who work in jobs that barely pay minimum wage who would be very happy to spend more time on their phones rather than taking care of all of us. So that said, I think there is a socioeconomic class of us who this is definitely a problem. And I see it by talking to, you know, there's very little in the way of curricula for any of these things. I talked to a lot of teachers yesterday. I was at the 800 educators who are really making it up as they go along. And they're amazing people. And people say to me, like, well, what is it the computer science teacher who you're talking to? I'm like, no, it's the English teacher, it's the health teacher, it's the biology teacher, it's the type of person who is looking at the kids in their classroom and saying, we got to talk about this. I have a lot of religion teachers, actually, who talk, which is really interesting to me. So it's a type of person who sees that what these kids need is actually almost to be taught to be with themselves. Mm-hmm. And I remember on my book tour last year, there was a young woman, I think she was 15, she'd come with her mom, and she said, this is really scary to me what you're talking about because I can't be alone. Mm-hmm. And just that, I like wanted to cry. I was like, oh, honey, you're going to be with you for a very long time, so you better get to know you. Like, it's going to be, it's okay, you know? And I almost think, you know, we see the rising levels of depression and anxiety, particularly in young women. Mm-hmm. And there is no studies done that say that the cause is social media, but there are certainly a lot of correlations, exactly.
Yeah. Does the screen usage vary by gender? Is there any gender differences in the research that you did for your book?
Not as far as I could see at all, actually. No. Mm-mm. I think parents had a little bit of a harder time, and gamers definitely had a harder time. They were the ones who cut down on their time the most. Mm-hmm. But I guess they were starting at a different level. Yeah.
A question from the audience. Do you think concerns over privacy will impact device usage? How does privacy and device usage come together?
I'm obsessed with the privacy thing. What an interesting time it is right now. We see that, of course, here in California, I mean, what an amazing, I think this new law that's supposed to go into effect in 2020, right, has really pushed lawmakers on Capitol Hill to look at a federal law going forward. And the jockeying that is going on right now is really interesting. Of course, millions are being spent on lobbyists by the tech companies to make sure that they get to decide how this all plays out. And I certainly do not trust the lawmakers to understand most of what the tech companies are asking for. If Senator Wyden was in charge, then I'd be happy. But I think the privacy thing is baked into all of this. I really do. And it's incredibly complicated. And it's no wonder people are like, oh, forget it. It's fine. It's fine. You can't read the terms of service. There's no point. I think that's why we have to focus on the self-regulation, because I worry that actual regulation is not going to take us far enough. Mm-hmm. There are some really interesting movements, of course, going on with Mozilla and the Omidyar Foundation, which just sort of has formed an ethical tech department. I don't know if anybody's from here. A couple other places, the Knight Foundation, there is a sort of coming together of like-minded people on this ethical tech thing. Mm-hmm. We need to get our acts together a little bit more, but it is happening. And I think Craig Newmark has been giving millions of dollars to, for example, Julia Angwin just left ProPublica. She is one of the people who's been doing algorithmic investigations into racism and other ways that algorithms are unfairly discriminate. And she is setting up her own newsroom specifically to do this. And he just gave her and her partners $20 million to launch their new journalism newsroom. So I think this is a burgeoning industry for journalists. I mm-hmm. think consumers are becoming more aware. And I think, you know, certainly the tech companies are as well. The question is, how far will they take it? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question from the audience. What is the difference between being bored and meditation?
Okay. I love this question. Two different brain networks, essentially. I had a conversation with Dan Harris. He 10% happier. He's ABC News correspondent. And he and I talked about it. We're like, how can we describe it? Like, there are two sides of the same coin, right? Meditation is attempting not to think, to allow for stasis almost in your brain, whereas and in many ways, that's a wonderful thing, pretty much. Mind wandering also, many psychologists will warn, there's a very dark side to mind wandering, which is ruminating, playing something, you know, OCD, playing something over and over in your brain, not being able to let it go. The mind wandering that I'm referring to, if we want to get into the weeds, is called positive constructive mind wandering. So that is the key difference.
Okay. Another question from the audience. As a parent, how do you resist the desire to fill the boredom for our kids?
Oh, my God.
And can I just say, it is heartbreaking to go to a public place, a restaurant or whatever, and you see a mom and a dad parents having a meal and a propped up iPad in front of a 2-year-old sitting in a high chair, and it just breaks my heart.
I'm trying not to judge. It is hard to be a parent today
with all the devices.
Yes. And also, I have been that mom who's in line in the supermarket and the toddler is having a meltdown and you're like, I just have to pay for our groceries and get the hell out of here. Look at the phone.
Yeah. And I mean, my kids are older, but it was, you know, a similar thing when my kids were young, it was baby Einstein. You were supposed to put in a VHS.
Yeah, they got sued, didn't they?
A big VHS cassette, and you put your toddler in front of the TV, and it was just like this red swirl, or this red and black swirling thing, like some sort of Rorschach test that's supposed to, you know, hypnotize them or something. And they're like, oh, it's stimulating their brains. It's making them so smart. And it was terrible for them.
Yeah. So I want to say, like, I try to give, you know, we don't know what that parent has gone through that day, whether they've just worked a 20-hour day and they haven't seen their spouse in a week and they need to just have a conversation. So I really want to give parents the benefit of the doubt. However, I think parents have gotten lazy. That, and I speak for myself. I think it's really easy to think like, oh my God, my child is bored, therefore I'm a bad parent. I need to stimulate his little brain. Let's give him a math game or something. Or we think, or instead of being like, go amuse yourself, I don't want to amuse myself. Like, we've lost our capacity to deal with belly aching and whining, I think a lot of us. It's easier to give them the device. So we need to build back the parenting calluses, I think, some of us. And also, I've seen like the weird stuff that kids get up to if you let them go through that uncomfortable period where they're bored, and then suddenly they're like, I made this amazing Lego thing. Ta-da! You know, like it's like anybody who's bored, right? It's uncomfortable. Oh, this is weird. What's that? Oh, that's interesting. Huh, what if I did that? Do you know what I mean? And then suddenly off you go. But you have to pass through that thing. I have had people who are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I mow my lawn every week and I'm not bored. And I'm like, well, you are, but you've just discovered how delicious it is. And so you don't use semantics mean a lot. Boredom is negative. You're chilling every week when you're mowing your lawn. And like, you know how to like get through the uncomfortable part really quick. But for some like teenagers who were like, I've never felt this. I don't like it. I don't want to do this. You're like, yeah, it's yucky at first, but
yeah,
you got it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Can you talk a little bit about what your research found in terms of digital photos or Snapchat or any sort of visual apps?
Yeah, that was day two, actually. We asked people to not take a photo for one day, just for one day. And it really depended very much on the age. I mean, it was definitely harder for teenagers and people in their 20s, without a doubt, because a lot of times, specifically like with Snapchat, they communicate via pictures. So that, I think, was really difficult for them and not always great. But I think also it opens a window to talk about things like Snapchat streaks, like designs in these apps. Anybody, you guys know streaks? Anybody?
Not you have to take a picture every single day. You have to
have a
picture every single day with a certain person.
Right. And don't break the streak.
You can't break the streak.
Because so it means your friendship's over.
Right. And so even if you're in another country or you're flat out for a couple of days with the flu, you have to take a picture and send it to the person in order to keep your streak going.
Right. And I was hearing of kids whose like their parents had taken away their phone, so they would give their login to a friend who could then log in as them and like not break the streak. I just think it's the one thing that I hope teenagers are still relatively good at is a little bit of rebellion. So if you explain to them how they're being like manipulated, a lot of times they get kind of mad and annoyed and then want to reclaim that. So I think it's a worthy conversation to have, whether they decide to change their habits or not. At least they're conscious of what is happening.
Did you ever check in with some of the people that you had in your experiment and sort of follow them along, like a couple years later? What are some of the long-term benefits or negative effects that they have seen by participating?
Yeah, so when I was getting ready to go on book tour, I put out the call. I was like, does anybody remember this weirdo experiment that we did? And I heard back from a lot of people. So Liam, the guy who deleted like a dozen apps off his phone, who kept them off his phone, he told me that he sets aside time every day to go on his laptop to do social media. And it's like, you know, half an hour every day. And he feels like it keeps him sane. Another young woman, this is the craziest story. She was breaking up with her boyfriend at the time of the original project with Bored and Brilliant. And they owned a farm together. So they had sort of had to decide what they were going to do with the farm. So she used Bored and Brilliant to allow her mind to wander. And what she ended up doing was she bought the farm from her boyfriend. She renamed it Make Time Farm, decided to throw herself into the whole thing and also open it to the community one Sunday every month as a place where you could come and space out or take a nap or write poetry or bring your sewing machine or whatever else, because she decided this was something that her community needed. They needed a place to be able to do that. So I thought that was amazing. It's in Wisconsin, apparently. I would love to go visit.
Very cool.
I know, right?
Is listening to music on your phone considered using your phone?
Well, that's up to you. I am not the boss of you. I mean, in terms of if you want it as a prompt to spacing out, it depends on the music, right? Like if you're like listening to Rachmaninoff and like jamming out and like doing it along, like whatever, that's not spacing out. But if it's just like music that sort of calms you and lets your mind go, then I would say, look, it's phone use, pure and simple. But if it's a productive prompt for you, then there's no reason not to.
What are some of the physical impacts of screen time on, we talked a little bit about kids. Is it different for adults? Like how it affects our brains and I don't know.
Sure.
Some of those effects.
Well, some of them you probably have had before where you think that your phone is vibrating, but it's actually your stomach rumbling. That has happened to me where I've been like, I have to answer. Oh, I'm hungry. So there's that. There's eye twitching, lack of sleep. I mean, you can, it goes from like minor to like stomach rumbling, and it goes all the way up to other things, which is, you know, feeling depressed or anxious when you turn it off. Again, like depression and anxiety, there's a lot of research being done into that, but, I mean, there's no conclusive. Gene Twenge, of course, out here is doing some research into that, but, the other physical manifestations, well, you know, feeling lost if you don't have your phone. It happened to me the other day where we left the house to go up the block and I'd left my phone behind and I panicked. And my kids were like, it's going to be okay. We're with you. Nothing can happen. We're with you. And they like, we went to the store. We bought something. We came. They were like, you did great. So like, this is stuff that I struggle with all the time. You know, author heal thyself. Like, I thought that I was the only lunatic, but like I particularly hear from a lot of people who work. So yesterday at the conference I was at in Sacramento, we had a lot of people who do the social media for their institution, for the college they work at. And they're like, I'm dying to get off these platforms, but I can't. It's my job. And so how do I set boundaries? How do I calm my brain? And I just think, you know, they are really struggling with this. I hear from a lot of therapists who like that is a huge complaint that they're or problem that their patients bring to them is inability to switch off. And one of the most interesting, one of the people I interviewed was Dr. Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist, who said, because I said to him, I was like, it's really weird. I will be so tired at the end of the day, and I'll put my kids to bed, and I should just like be collapsed in the playroom listening to their sweet breaths, right? But I'm not. I'm like this. on Pinterest looking at sofas, but not even really looking at sofas. And he said, well, it makes total sense because the brain has a limited capacity for decision making. Like every morning you wake up with a finite amount of glucose. And if you open your email at 9 a.m. and you're like, oh, I'm going to answer that one. I'm going to forward that one. I'm going to file that one. You know what? I'm going to respond. No, I'm not going to respond. That's five decisions that you've made right there. And you're burning through, we're burning through glucose earlier and earlier in the day. So by the time, you know, the end of the evening, you are depleted. Like we are not machines. We are not computers. The computer can keep going, but we cannot. So it was really, I'm such a, in case you can't tell, super type A person who was like, I am going to wring every moment out of this day. He's like, stop. You can't. You have glucose like issues. I'm like, oh, that explains why I want candy when I'm on social media. He's like, yep, it's neuroscience. So it all makes sense when
is there a connection between social media use or technology use in general and other addictions? Like, can someone translate?
Okay, all right. Very loaded.
Okay, but some other extreme habits? Can you transfer an extreme habit of technology to something else? Like I'm going to be, I don't know, hypothetically, I'm going to turn off my phone for a week, but then I'm so nervous and jumpy, I eat, you know, two chocolate cakes a day. And then at the end of the week, I was like, well, you know, in order to get this weight off, I got to go back to my phone or something. I mean, is it?
I am not a psychologist. I only interview them. but I would say that, you know, there's definitely psychological effects from our tech use. There is no doubt about that. And there's finally starting to be papers and research done into that. And depending on what country you're in, tech addiction is a thing. So it's a thing in South Korea. It's a thing, I believe, in France.
Like a diagnosable. A diagnosis.
But that it is not here in the United States. So it's a thing in Israel. It's a thing in very tech savvy countries other than here, bizarrely. Because that would get in the way of innovation if we classified it. It's really a cultural decision about how, but you know, they in Japan, definitely you've heard of these kids who don't come out of their room for days.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is your average screen time?
Oh, it's not good. Can you imagine what it was if I didn't write the book? Like that would be bad. I find, especially like when I'm on the road and I'm away from my family, I'm actually on my phone less because I check in with them because I have time to myself when I'm on the road. I can take an hour and go for a walk like I did this morning. And I will be very purposeful about not checking my phone. And I find that that really sets the tone for the day. Whereas if I'm at home, I'm on my phone coordinating pickup and drop off. And did you get the thing? And I got to do, you know, you're doing so many different things that that sets the tone for the day. And I hear that from a lot of people that taking in mind some of the things in this book, they'll get to their desk in a different mindset, which helps them set their intention, how they want to interact with their, with everything for the entire day. And, you know, it's okay to close Slack for an hour. Mm-hmm. Like it's okay. And maybe it's actually good. So, yeah.
So a question from the audience. The business model of a lot of these companies is really based on monetizing our personal data.
Yes.
And for users to be willing to give away our data for in exchange for free services. So is there any indication in your research that we're on our way to changing this paradigm?
I think Mozilla actually is a really good an interesting example in that they are trying to bake their ethics into their tech products. Like Firefox is one of the most ethical browsers out there in terms of tracking. I don't see it changing as long as it's ad dollars that are paying for all of this. You know, Google and Facebook, they take the majority of the ad dollars, which means that journalism is struggling, and as long as we are in we're being targeted with the time spent with our eyeballs as a measure of success, that the more clicks and the more engagement, as it's called, rather than the depth of that experience, I don't see that changing. I mean, my fantasy, and I actually like spelled it out today to the, like, we run ads on our podcast. Like, it's one of the ways that we are able to pay the bills, and I'm very transparent. I have a new podcast, Zigzag. But I have this fantasy of what if we could curate the ads so that when you listen to Zigzag, you knew that it had a seal of approval, that the product was ethical in some way, that it had your best intentions at heart, that its business model was not based on exploiting your personal information or your time. And that, I think, would be a huge service. I would love there to be sort of a collective, like, tech that cares about this stuff, that they're making it part of their business model, and that that's a selling point to consumers, that that's good for their business. That would be a wonderful thing. I think we can get there, actually. That I do feel optimistic about.
How many apps does the average person have on their phone? Is there any data?
Oh, there is data on that. What is it? It's something like 65, I think, is the average.
Holy smokes.
I think that's right.
That was
more
than
they
thought.
Only open a tiny percentage.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the number, I think you can find that in your screen time, iOS. So I'm not sure. But if you think about it, like, there's only a few that you open.
What is your favorite app? Most useful.
I do love Twitter. I mean, I love-hate relationship with Twitter, you know? Like, some days I am super into it, and I am talking to listeners, and I am learning new things, and then other days I'm like, this sucks, and I turn it off.
Yeah.
And that's not good for the company, you know what I mean? That's not good if you're at a point where people are, like, almost willing to, like, quit. Like, because maybe it's a small percentage of the user base, but it's a very influential percentage, I think, who are doing this.
You know what you say in your book?
What
did I say in my book? It's the drug industry and technology are industries
yeah.
that classify their customers as
that.
Users.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's true. That's true. It's
I read that
only,
in your book. I was like, that was pretty
funny. I didn't say that. It's a quote.
It
of course launched a debate on Twitter when I said it in my TED talk about like who really said it, and a bunch of white dudes all wanted to take credit for it. So yeah, only drug dealers and technologists call their customers users.
Yeah.
Which is really funny and true, and I didn't say it, so let the record
show. I read it in your book.
There is the debate rages on as to where the source is.
My favorite app is MLB.com.
Oh, really?
Oh,
that's your thing?
National Baseball League. At bat. So good.
Really?
Oh, my God. You can follow every strike, every pitch, every nuance of every game. It's
and how is it monetizing?
Awesome.
What's its business model?
Probably it's measuring my eyeball time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But ads? Is it serving you ads?
That's interesting. I don't even notice the ads. There might be ads.
Yeah, but there might be, right?
And I don't even know it.
Well, that's the other thing is like
I don't
we're
pay
all getting
for it.
Used to this. Like I had listeners who were like, I hate that you run ads. I will listen to them and I will never, never, never act on them. But keep running them because you need the money. And then I had another person who was like, I love you so much that I go to every URL that you say in your ads just so they know that people are actually listening. I mean, oh my God. Only podcast listeners would do weird shit like that. like I have never, there nobody else is doing strange things like that. And then other people are really annoyed. They're like, you talk this talk and you're running ads. Like, not cool. I'm like, well, you know, maybe we'll end up doing Patreon or something like that.
Yeah.
But right now we're just trying to make it work.
Yeah. Let's close off with a question from the audience. You made a bit of a career change and you started your own company.
I did, yeah.
What can you tell us about that journey? What you did? What did you learn? Your biggest surprise?
Yeah. So I quit my job in April. I ran away with my executive producer. And she and I formed our own company. And we did it, well, there were several reasons, all of which are documented in our new podcast. One was that we had a philanthropist come to us and say, the work you're doing on tech and ethics should be bigger. We want to give you a grant. The other reason was Cambridge Analytica just like happened. And that was a story I had been covering for a while. I had donated my data to a lawsuit in the UK. And the third is really unfortunate. There was a big Me Too situation at New York Public Radio. I was not involved personally, but was unimpressed with the way it was handled. And so all those things kind of came together and made us think like, why? Let's do it. Let's jump. Let's do our own thing. And then the grant fell through the minute we quit our jobs. So that was great.
Bummer.
But it worked out in a very strange way in that a mystery blockchain company came to our rescue. They are called Civil. They are using blockchain to try and create a new ecosystem for journalists, getting rid of the ad model by having a cryptocurrency. It's a combination of, can I just say the most boring sentence on the planet? A combination of crypto economics and game theory to launch a token economy. And the token sale failed this week. But I know. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, that's great. Because season one of ZigZag explains how confused we were as well and documents our understanding of some of the promise of blockchain, what the hell blockchain is, how it should work. Two moms who got rid of their stable jobs, how we're trying to make it work. I think you can't report about these things. If you bring a personal narrative to it, then we had women entrepreneurs who were listening and who were like, oh my God, I feel for you and Jen. And that's really interesting about blockchain. Now I finally understand it. And then you had some bros who were like, yeah, you got that one thing wrong about the crypto. But also, because of the women stuff you were talking about, I had a really good conversation with my wife about her career, so thank you. And I'm like, look at that. Come for the blockchain, come for the crypto, but stay for the female empowerment, right? And so we have found this, it's not as big as Note to Self yet, but we're only 4 months old, and it's been a crazy journey, and we just started season two, and our theme this season is trust and misinformation. And I think it's about trust for us as co-founders. How do you, I mean, I don't know, startup people, this is like a big thing. How do you trust this company that is trying to create what seems like a worthy idea with blockchain and journalism, but I don't know I don't know if it's going to work. And trust, I think that we need to try and rebuild in our government, certainly in our communities. And I think that the tech companies need to do that as well. So
great.
That makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
This was super fun. Thanks
great.
For having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So thank you, everyone. This brings this meeting of the Commonwealth Club to a close. I will close it with my gavel.